this is Jeff Spanner from Americans in France, and I am talking with Tony Pascal. Tony, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Jeff. Hi, good morning.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm good, thanks. And you?
I'm all right, thank you. Where are you?
I'm in Paris. I'm in the 13th arrondissement on the south edge of Paris.
How long have you been there for?
I've been in Paris since 1983.
What's it like as an American in Paris?
Well, I live in a really atypical neighborhood. I'm on the edge of Chinatown, and in a part of the city that's gone through a lot of urban renewal recently. So it doesn't look like the museum town that you see in the center of the city. The city's on a human scale. It's still easy to get around on foot. I ride bike everywhere.
Are there lots of bike paths in Paris?
There are over 200 kilometers of bike paths in the city now, yeah. 5 years ago, I guess, they got the bike share program going, and they've worked really hard to provide access for bikers on the street.
Yeah, what's that called again?
It's Vélib.
Vélib, yeah. Too, they have a thing now with cars where you can rent a car for like a half hour or an hour or something.
That started last December. It's a electric car share, and there are stations all around the city, and you unplug your car and get in and drive away and stop at another station and plug it back in.
Tell me what you do, because you are the founder of the Union for Overseas Voters, right?
Union of Overseas Voters, yeah.
What is that?
Well, we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan association, and our mission is to help Americans abroad register to vote and to inform them about their voting rights. And we also do a lot of outreach to school communities to inform future voters about the procedures for voting and the advantages of voting, the reasons why you want to vote. 2 weeks ago, we did a keynote address at an American-style international high school, speaking to students from six nations about voting. So the curious thing is that as the world becomes globalized, more and more citizens are working and living away from their home countries. So this is an issue that Americans have a lot of experience with. We got the right to vote from overseas in 1975. There are younger nations, like Tunisia, for example, that are just experiencing their first overseas vote this past year. Britons were at one time allowed to vote even after living overseas just up to 20 years. That was reduced to 15 years, so now they're struggling to get lifetime privileges. So we see ourselves as part of a larger global movement to assist global citizens in staying connected with the political processes in their home countries.
You know, what's interesting is that in France now it's possible for the overseas voters, the expats, can vote, and they also have representation in the parliaments.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. That's one of the problems that we face as Americans trying to mobilize other Americans to vote, because even though we have the right guaranteed us by federal law to vote in federal elections, our residency requirements and our votes are actually counted in each state where we formerly lived. And the states determine our right to vote in state and local elections, and even whether we have a right to claim a state address as an address for voting in federal elections.
I know it's pretty much a hodgepodge, because I know people in American citizens abroad. I was talking to a woman there, and she said it's kind of there are different laws, different states have different laws. And
it is a hodgepodge because we're in a states' rights regime where the states determine your residency. And they also determine the rules for registering and applying for ballots. So there are some states which don't have registration, voter registration at all. Some states are more strict with that. That's one of the remarkable things about what we do, is that we're able to see people from all 50 states and five U.S. territories and help them with voting. If I can tell you one story, this is just an example of the kind of problem we run into. A couple years ago, we met an older woman who was at the time in her late 70s and wanted to vote. She'd never voted in the United States. She'd never lived in the United States. She was a child of an American diplomat. She was born overseas, educated overseas, married overseas. When she came to us, we asked the usual question, which is, where did you last live in the United States? And of course, she didn't have an answer. As we talked with her, we learned her history about her father. We just decided that, well, she said she did remember an episode when he, after he retired, he returned to Washington, D.C. to complete some of his retirement paperwork, and he just stayed for a brief period. So we just decided that we would use the address of the State Department as her residency. This is the only place we could put her in the United States. This was accepted, so she has been able to vote now as a citizen of Washington, D.C. Since we registered her. But this is the difficulty that we face. It's because, unlike France, where it's one big pot, you know, it's universal suffrage, everybody's ballot goes into the same big dish, and they're all counted. In the United States, they're counted where you last lived. And it's that particular place that's going to determine your right to place that ballot in that box.
Right now, it's the summer of an election year. Should I have already applied for my ballot?
What the Federal Voting Assistance Program has always advised, and what we always advise, is that at the first of the year, after the 1st of January, you just file a request. So if people haven't filed a request, they need to do that right away.
In the beginning of the year, in January, you should actually request your ballot. Even if you voted in the last election, you should always request a ballot.
Yeah, the case of California is a good one because counties in California maintain permanent voting registration. So you can be permanently registered, and that's all well and good, but the policies in your county could change, and they could say, well, even though he's permanently registered, he didn't request his ballot, so we're just not going to send one this year. You could be permanently registered in your county in California, and they would keep your name on the rolls forever, but in any particular year, they could change the policies and just say, well, he didn't file a request for a ballot this year, so we're just not going to send him one.
So if you don't request a ballot, then you can't send in the federal write-in ballots.
In most states, that's the rule. So that's why we really recommend that people file the paperwork every year. We are running the first and third Saturdays of every month. We're at Shakespeare and Company Bookshop in the shadow of Notre Dame down on the left bank.
The last person I was talking to was an accountant, and we were talking about things like the FACA and the FBAR, which are incredibly intrusive and that Americans have to fill out because it's mandated by the federal government.
Another reason for voting is simply to remind our election officials in the United States that we are overseas and we have very particular needs and interests.
When did you first arrive in France?
I came in at the end of 83. I came to study French because I was going to go into a teaching job in North Africa. That was actually a Peace Corps assignment. And once I got here and had enrolled in school and said goodbye to the United States, Peace Corps funding ran out. So I ended up staying and making it work.
How did you make it work?
I had money to live on because I had prepared that for just the period I was going to be in school. And then I started working for Lily Havland, and I started doing other work. At the time, one could still enroll in university here and get the visa without having to return to the United States. Yeah, you could no longer do that. And so I was able to do that, and I actually enrolled in a teaching English as a foreign language program, which was what I wanted to do.
What has changed over the years in France?
One of the things that people still don't believe is that when I first came, there were only three television channels here, and there was no television before 1 o'clock in the afternoon. In the 70s and even in the early 80s when I came, you could still sense that the city was still recovering from World War II. Even today, you know, there's a huge housing shortage, and a lot of that is kind of leftover from all the devastation that occurred in World War I and World War II, the lack. So one had a sense that, in the 70s particularly, one really had a sense that you were kind of going back in time when you came here from the United States. I think before World War II, wasn't it something like 80% of the French population lived on the farm?
Yeah, you know, that's always a recurring theme, I mean, of rural France.
Of rural France. And it also has shaped the sociology of the cities, because when you break into, you know, French culture and you start making French friends, I was rather astounded to discover that even though you're in a city of 2 million people and 10 million in the greater Paris area, people still associate with their peers who were also children of people from their village. So if they're not native Parisians, oftentimes they keep the relationships that their parents cultivated in their native villages. It's one of the things that I brought out when we did our keynote address at this high school graduation a couple of weeks ago. And even though they are not Americans. They shared something essentially American, which is that they understood what it was to be uprooted. And that's something that's so common in the United States. You know, we cross the continent for jobs. And here, even though they may go to the big city, the family house still is back in the village. The roots are very, very strong. It's a different experience in France of origin.
Also, a much older country, obviously, and I think the roots are more deeper.
Geographically, France is about two-thirds the size of Texas, and one of the ways you can sense this, the depth of the roots here, is by looking at how many and how different the accents are in the provinces. What's interesting is that when you have Americans who come here and you learn French and you're in a region like that with a strong accent, oftentimes people will pick it up. That's all part of the experience of the deeper experience of living overseas. It takes time to be able to hear the difference in the accent.
Talking about the language, when you came here, how was your French?
My French was sort of like high school French, and I took a 6-month intensive language course in a private language school.
How long did it take you before you felt comfortable?
I think things started clicking after about a year. And, you know, then there are the little tricks you learn, like when you're in the market, if you don't know if it's masculine or feminine, you ask for two. You know, if the vegetable that you want is masculine or feminine, rather than asking for one and using the un or une, which could mean something else, you ask for two. Of course, sometimes you get home with more vegetables than you want. I just wanted to say one thing about tourism. One thing that we'll need to keep in mind, and I try to remind my American visitors of this, is that the United States, the mass of the North American continent that constitutes the United States, gets 50 million international visitors a year. France, which is two-thirds the size of Texas, gets 75 million. And the population of the country is only 16 million. So basically the country is almost constantly being overrun by foreigners, the international visitors. So that doesn't count all the French people that are moving around and also putting stress on the nice people who work in the tourism industry. So I just try to tell people, you know, just if you're here for a visit, enjoy it. Don't be too focused on your checklist of what you have to do and see, because life may not be exactly suited to that sort of approach in France. You know, you may just want to sit down on a cafe terrace and have a coffee and enjoy life.
What's something that you don't like about France?
One thing I don't like about France, and this goes back to what we were saying before, is if they don't understand you, rather than making an attempt, they will say, oh, well, that simply doesn't exist. Standard response, ça n'existe pas. So if you ask for something and you made a mistake in the pronunciation, this doesn't happen too often to me anymore, but it was really common. You make a mistake in the pronunciation, they don't quite understand. They don't try to wrap their head around it. They won't make the effort, and they'll just simply say, ça n'existe pas. It doesn't exist.
Do you have any suggestions for people moving to France? Or who are thinking of moving to France?
I would, of course, the thing is to learn the language. And you want to understand that your best way of getting rooted here or feeling at home here is going to be to make French friends. And you're going to need the language for that. And it's also a process that takes time. The social distances are very different in the United States and in France. In the United States, we open our arms and you know, invite the new neighbors in and things like that. And it may take time for that to happen here. But that's not unusual. That doesn't have anything to do with you. It doesn't have anything to do with them being particularly reserved. It's just the way it's done.
Okay, Tony. Thank you very much. It's been really nice talking with you.
Thank you, Jeff. This has been a pleasure.